Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18-plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yes, please. This is an emergency. Please send a squad to Pierce Butler Road, Muhlenberg Manufacturing Company, machine shop. Please, there's an ambulance, too. There's a girl hurt there.
Can you tell me what happened to her?
Just hurry. She's laying on the ground in the back by the railroad tracks, by the edge here.
What's the address?
I don't know.
Who are you?
January 1st, 1981. A cold Minnesota winter rolled in to serve as a numbing reminder for one woman, Karen Potak, of the cruelty in the world. She was discovered naked beside the railroad tracks near a machine shop in St. Paul. Her brain had sustained several serious injuries, and the rest of her body had been beaten with a tire iron. She survived the attack, but spent the following years recovering physically and mentally. In fact, she was without her memory of the event, even by the time she had done all of her physical recovery, a process which was much quicker than anticipated. The odd fact about Karen, though, was that her injuries were reported before the officers and the ambulance even arrived on the scene. There had, in fact, been a phone call from someone to report that there was a girl hurt in the vicinity, and the injuries and the location of the victim in question were reported with great accuracy. Unfortunately, when authorities arrived, Karen's body was broken in several places, and she was alone. No one was there to accompany her. No one to keep her sheltered from the cold. Who then had called about the hurt woman? Who had been the high-pitched voice warning police for Karen? The college student who had just come home to party and get wasted with friends the night of New Year's Eve. Eventually, more calls were made, and the whining, whimpering voice on the other line was discovered to be more than an onlooker. The voice that dispatchers heard that day, and several times afterward, was the voice of an actual killer, and the officials in the Twin Cities would soon hear his voice again. The weepy-voiced killer, as they came to know him, would strike again.
You are listening to Devil We Know, a true crime podcast, which may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of the show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
Everywhere we look, everywhere we go, every city, every town, every neighborhood, every street, there is a devil we know. This is Devil We Know, and I am your host, Aaron.
Kimberly Compton was broke. At least that's what she told the welfare office in Duluth when she awoke in the city that warm day in June of 1981. She had just graduated from Pepin High School 2 weeks ago. A proud day for the young girl who had just a year before that run away from her foster parents. Kimberly, according to the folks in her little hometown of Pepin, Wisconsin, was considered an average small town high school girl. She didn't drink, and she didn't use drugs. She had only run away a couple times before, each in succession. The first time she had left her foster parents, at that time, she was underage, and she was seen into a juvenile facility for 2 weeks before she made a run for it once more. That run ended in St. Paul, where she lived on her own for approximately 2 weeks. That all happened about a year before her next trip. This time she had actual business to attend to. She picked up her copy of C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, The Last Battle, a coin purse, some luggage, and a shoulder bag. Wherever she was headed, it was very possible she intended it to be permanent. After all, for a recent 18-year-old and historical runaway, Kimberly was likely to be feeling a need to free herself from the life she had in Pepin. It was a quick departure. She had left her relatives and friends for St. Paul on Monday, June 1st. However, only having been a graduate for a fortnight, she was penniless and wayward. Soon after arriving in St. Paul, she took yet another bus for Duluth, where she slept overnight to await the daytime when she would approach the welfare office. When she told the office her current predicament, she was given $2 for food and a bus ticket to Wabasha, Minnesota. She took another bus with this ticket, which ended up back in St. Paul. She stepped off in a familiar city, which had sheltered her for a time as a fickle youth. It was here, then, that Kimberly decided to leave her luggage in her shoulder bag in one of the bus station lockers. Perhaps she thought that she'd have better luck securing a place to stay without all her junk in the way. Perhaps she even considered leaving it all behind to start anew, donning only a red jacket, cut-off blue jeans, and a white t-shirt with a Bengal tiger emblazoning the front of it. Whatever the case, she left her things and headed out to find a bite to eat and maybe search for some help. According to later eyewitness accounts, she apparently did find someone she thought could help her. A cabbie from the St. Paul area identified her later, having left the bus station with a man. Although his memory seemed to come back from multiple questionings, his description of the man Kimberly was with made up one of multiple that just didn't seem to match up. For instance, two employees at the inn, a hotel on 7th Street, affirmed seeing someone that fit Kimberly's description with an older white man with a pot belly. The cab driver, however, mentioned seeing a younger man with curly, dark hair that looked to be of Puerto Rican descent. Neither of these descriptions seemed to have anything in common regarding Kimberly's companion during her time in the city. Sure, Kimberly could have been spending time with multiple men during her week in Minnesota. But the most likely scenario, due to the lateness and nature of each eyewitness account, is that the descriptions were just not dependable. It happens on occasion. Eyewitness accounts, though used often in criminal trials, are forms of subjective evidence that is highly volatile and susceptible to change in the right conditions. The onset of time, for one, is a condition that can affect the accounts of a so-called witness of the event. That said, it was a long time before the connections were made to the man who last saw Kimberly alive.
Kimberly was found June 3rd on a plot of grass in western St. Paul. The evening of her discovery, three young boys had come across her, lying feet away from a manhole near the streets of Superior and Oneida. A few feet off of the beaten path lay Kimberly's body, partially undressed, with marks on her neck that suggested possible strangulation to later investigators. However, what really stood out to the medical examiners who looked at Kimberly were the puncture wounds. In fact, the most shocking thing was the number of wounds. There were accounted 61 puncture wounds in all, and all of Kimberly's vital organs were pierced by the weapon in question. The examiners in the case first believed the wounds to be made by a long, sharp screwdriver. For this murder, though, the strangest thing was not the state in which the body was found,
The strangest thing about it was not even in the way Kimberly was killed. No, the strangest thing of all was this one simple fact. Whoever did it had called in the crime. The 911 dispatchers received a series of harrowing calls from the killer himself. Clearly a man with a high-pitched, distressed, and distorted voice. This man, the weepy-voiced killer, had even called 30 minutes before the body was found to report his own crime. His lamentations were emotional and hurried, urging the police to come find him before he killed again. The killer admitted to stabbing somebody with an ice pick in a chilling and whiny tone that would later continually haunt law enforcement as they searched for the so-called weepy-voiced killer. Kimberly, who had been an epileptic, was treated some time ago at the Mayo Clinic. When officials responded to the boy's findings and the call from the mystery killer, they checked the body of the victim to find a patient ID that positively ensured the name of St. Paul's newest murder victim, Kimberly Compton. It wasn't only the police that knew her name now, though. The killer, who no doubt followed the news of his transgression closely, called in again to the police, reporting himself and claiming that he wanted to turn himself in. He didn't do so, of course, but it was clear to the authorities now that this man was the same caller both times. Medical examiners had looked into another clue into what had happened that day, discovering that Kimberly's stomach contents consisted of barbecue and fries, the daily special for Mickey's, a small local eatery across the street from the bus station. The examiners determined that Kimberly died less than 2 hours after getting off of the bus, so the story was getting a little clearer. Whomever Kimberly was seen with, whoever took her life, was likely in the restaurant planning his next move, when she was eating the barbecue beef, pickle, and french fries that served as her last supper. When the newspapers began to report the details of Kimberly's murder in hopes of finding willing testimonies to the events of that day, another call soon followed, this time rebutting the facts of the case. He states that the number of stab wounds was over-exaggerated, and on June 11th, the faint, distraught voice rang out to the 911 dispatchers once more. "Don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry what I did to Compton," he whimpered, continuing his short plea, discussing with the dispatcher how upset he was over his own actions. These calls or communiques between the killer and the police seemed to take on a life of their own, as the perpetrator in question continually called in, perhaps to clear his conscience. This frightening harbinger of guilt seemed to not actually want to be caught, though. When two of his calls were traced, the police found them each to be at separate payphones, miles away from each other. One was found near the bus station, while another came from Butler Square, all the way in Minneapolis. It was a wild goose chase, and police were unsure how to continue. They released portions of the call to media outlets in the area, in the hopes that someone would recognize the high-pitched voice that cried about his crimes. The last call was one of the few released to the media, a chilling whine that ruminated on prison and suicide, the latter of which was considered preferable to imprisonment.
"Don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry what I did to Compton. I couldn't help it. Don't know why I had to stab her. I am so upset about it. I keep getting drunk every night. I can't believe it. It's like a big dream. I can't think of being locked up. If I get locked up, I'd kill myself. I'd rather kill myself than get locked up. I'll try not to kill anybody else."
We will be right back after these short messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
"Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time."
"No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky."
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The death of Kimberly Compton struck hard in St. Paul. As law enforcement cracked down on those that they thought were likely suspects in the case. As the Star Tribune put it, the cops were thoroughly stumped because several times they thought they had their man. However, with the probability lowering each time that their hottest suspects were, in fact, the killer in question, they realized that there was still a sickie roaming the Twin Cities, begging the police to catch him before he beats or stabs another victim. There was a point in early 1982 where the police believed firmly that they had found their man. A man by the name of Alan Lopez had just committed the murders of his father, mother, and sister, and he had barricaded himself within his parents' home. When the police tried to reach him by the phone, he then spoke on the phone, confessing to one St. Paul policeman that he had, in fact, also killed Kimberly Compton and stabbed another girl in July, just 1 month after Kimberly's death. The stabbing victim survived, but she and a helpful passerby were no help in identifying the perpetrator that stabbed her. In fact, she had suffered many emotional problems before the act. So between her fragile state at the young age of 20 and the passerby who helped her, the attacker responsible for her 27 stab wounds was not able to be accurately described. So Alan took the fall, but Alan, it seemed, had an alibi. Before and after his suicide in the state security hospital at St. Peter, the courts found excuses for placing him in the hospital during an attack on Karen Potack, which the police had already figured was committed by the same perpetrator as Kimberly's killer. Then, Alan was discovered later to have been in a county detention center during the crimes of 1981, which were believed by police to be connected due to the M.O. of multiple stabbings. Alan, who died in his own cell at that hospital, had been exonerated. At least one of the crimes that didn't concern his family, despite trying to take credit for them. All that and the press that circulated these crimes didn't stop the weepy voice killer from making his next move. In fact, it seemed that at this point, nothing could stop him. Not even his wavering voice and cowering conscience. Another body was found along the Mississippi River banks separating St. Paul and Minneapolis. This time, the woman in question turned up near Minneapolis by a newspaper delivery man at about 6:30 a.m. on August 6 of 1982. The woman's blouse was found open, and she was later identified as 40-year-old Barbara Simmons, whose last night alive was spent at the Hexagon Bar in the city. The police investigating her murder soon were also given reason to believe in the connection between Barbara Simmons and the killer of Kimberly Compton 14 months prior. The connection, of course, was yet another phone call. True to form, the weepy voice killer once again called police in an attempt to report his crime and as an apparent cry for help. Not only did he call saying that he killed that girl, but he admitted to stabbing her 40 times. Although the stab wounds totaled over 100 in Barbara when she was found. The most significant sign of connection, though, besides the telltale whining of the mystery man's voice, was his second mission. Kimberly Compton was the first over in St. Paul. He proceeded to tell the 911 dispatcher that he was sick and that he didn't know what was wrong with him.
Play your emergency.
Please don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry, I killed that girl. I stabbed her 40 times. Kimberly Compton was the first one. Oh, my shame. Oh, I don't know what's the matter with me. I'm sick. I'm going to kill myself, I think.
Where are you?
I'm just going to... If somebody dies with a red shirt on, it's me. I killed both of them. I'm sorry. I'll never make it to heaven.
Calm down.
His phone call, which ended with the fire emergency dispatcher telling the killer to calm down, directly followed the murder and discovery of Barbara, whose body had been stabbed over and over. And voice analysis technology helped to confirm that the killer in this case was in fact the same as the killer who called following Kimberly Compton's murder. Whoever the man was, he was continuing his killing streak, giving his trademark phone calls to the police to plead with them and apologize profusely for his misdeeds. It was unclear of his motivation for the killings, but it was clear from his calls that he did, in fact, have a pattern. After killing Barbara, his phone call stated another key fact. He had attacked women wearing red shirts. Barbara, with her blouse, and Kimberly, with her jacket, had been prime targets for the mystery man, whose M.O. had seemed all at once to be so odd and disconcerting to the people who knew him as the weepy-voiced killer.
Police began to pick up the pace with their investigation into Barbara Simon's murder, checking with the staff of the Hexagon Bar, the murder victim's last known location. The police had learned that Barbara left that night with a man who had bummed a cigarette from her during an exchange at the bar. Staff members who were present that night sat through a rigorous verification process, where police showed photos of men of a certain description with arrest records for crimes against women. It was then that the waitress who served Barbara that night told officers that she recognized one man as the man that Barbara thought was cute and would be giving her a ride home that night. The man was 37-year-old Paul Michael Stefani. Paul, who had a previous conviction for aggravated assault. He had been fired in 1977 from the Malberg Manufacturing Company. This company was located right where the first victim of the weepy-voiced killer, Karen Potak, was found clinging to life after a brutal beating in which she experienced severe brain damage. Paul at this time was singled out and considered a suspect in the crime, and police began to notice the connections that existed between him and some of the other crimes, specifically Karen's attack. At this point, Sergeant Don Brown confirmed that Paul had become the number one suspect in the case, and he was placed under surveillance. It was during this time that he, one fateful night, discovers he's being tailed and proceeds to shake the detectives that were keeping an eye on him. After losing the police, Paul soon made his way to the red light district of Minneapolis, where he met a sex worker by the name of Denise Williams. Denise, who had been working for 6 years on the streets by the age of 19, met Paul and got into the car after he offered her $100 to have some fun with him. The two of them headed to Paul's apartment, where Paul gave Denise $40 to perform sexual acts on him on the spot, promising her the other $60 later on. After the stint of so-called fun, though, Paul only offered Denise a ride back to her corner. The remainder of her pay, it seemed, was nowhere in sight. But as Denise later noted in court, what could she do about it? Not with somebody as big as him. So, she relented and agreed to ride back with him, assuming he would simply take the highway back the way he'd come. He didn't, though. Paul, who had a lot on his mind, took the long way. And when Denise questioned him on where he was going, he simply replied, Hennepin Avenue. Denise, who had been working these streets since she was 13, knew that something was amiss. First, the dark suburban roads instead of a lit street were clearly to avoid being seen, and Paul had referred to the route as a shortcut. Street-savvy Denise knew better. Then, as Paul drove her along, he told Denise of his sexual fantasies, and Denise distinctly remembers getting the creeps during this encounter. Paul drove on a little longer before eventually winding up in a dead-end parking lot where he accosted her for ass, grass, or gas in terms of payment for the ride. He insisted to Denise that no one rides for free, both lines seemingly torn from a terrible thriller movie. Denise knew that the jig was up. She wasn't getting her money, and this guy was not safe to be around. She reached for the car handle, attempting to leave the vehicle. Paul, right at the same moment, reached for Denise's wrist, keeping her in place while he drove a screwdriver through her body, one stab at a time. Denise hit Paul with a soda bottle in the throes of the conflict, and she cut his face and hand while Paul continued stabbing her. He began to scream in a really high-pitched voice, insisting that Denise was just like the rest of some other broads. Meanwhile, Denise scratched, bit, and kicked to fight Paul away and save herself from further blows. She then successfully opened the passenger door, both individuals flying from the vehicle and onto the pavement below. Denise played dead, but Paul continued to stab her. She then tried to call out for help, the broken bottle still secure in her hand. Doug Panning, who lived nearby, heard the calls and rushed to Denise's aid, grabbing Paul's left arm as he thrust the screwdriver with a sick thud deep into the organs and bone of Denise's dwindling body. Paul felt Doug grab him, and he turned to face the heroic passerby, wielding the screwdriver at him now with fervor. Doug ran back to the house with Paul chasing him on the way, and when he reached home, he phoned the police to report the incident. Paul, scared off by Doug's actions, got in the car and fled the scene, and Doug returned to Denise to help her maintain consciousness, lying in wait for the responders. The police and emergency transport arrived for her soon afterwards, and in fear of the legal trouble she'd find in giving the facts, Denise told everyone on the scene that her name was Mary Gross. She had run afoul of the law before, and at the time it seemed prudent to avoid doing it again altogether.
Meanwhile, Paul had arrived back at his apartment, calling a police dispatcher to report that he'd been beat up. He noticed that he was bleeding and assumed he needed medical attention. His call to 911, though, had an adverse effect. Not only did his voice sound remarkably like that of the so-called weepy voice killer, but in pursuing medical care, his whereabouts were immediately available to the police, who had been looking for their lost perp for hours. Not long after being found, he was once again under the microscope in the ongoing investigation of Barbara Simon's murder. The newest developments regarding Paul Stefani included the arrest and conviction for the crimes against the woman, now taking an alias as Mary Gross. After the case occurred, though, it was discovered that Mary was actually Denise Williams, and Paul himself moved against the court to state that he was not provided a fair and speedy trial due to Denise's deception. Paul Stefani, who grew up in a religious household in Austin, Minnesota, had obviously exhibited symptoms of guilt and remorse in his acts against the women of the Twin Cities. However, this appeal against the state of Minnesota, which Paul was not awarded, was a manifestation of another crucial aspect of the killer's personality: self-preservation. Although he cried on the phone to dispatchers about his crimes, he never once gave away his name during the calls. What's more, his habit of hanging up when more astute questions were asked over the phone to him proved that he was in fact a conflicted murderer. Perhaps his calls were a cry for help, an attempt to get caught and be stopped, but he expressed to one dispatcher that he'd rather die than end up in jail, while he told another that there was no way he'd get into heaven, having done the things he'd done. Paul's appeal, which ended in him still receiving a total of 18 years in prison for the crimes against Denise and Doug, was a wash, and soon it was time to bring him to the forefront of the other investigation that was still being pursued, that of Barbara Simons and her murder earlier that same month. Paul, when being taken in after seeking medical attention, was made to believe that the police were on his side. They sat Paul down and he was shown pictures of the other woman linked to the attacker. They knew only as the weepy voice killer. When Paul viewed these photos, his telltale whine began to pick up. It was thanks to this circumstantial evidence that Paul was then accused of killing Barbara in addition to his attacks on Denise and Doug later that same month. But that hard work was far from over. Although his voice was remarkably similar in that interview to the voice that appears on the tape calls, no one figured Paul yet as the actual guilty party. Voice analysis tests had been the groundwork of the case against Paul and all of the cases related to the Weepy Voice killer. But it was not hailed as an accurate representation of the facts in the 1980s. Trust for computers and for new tests and association with criminal court had not gone very far yet, so the test administered was considered inadmissible. Analysis had found a distinct similarity in the voices of Paul, but without the go-ahead from the judge, the prosecution needed to find another way. They even got Paul's ex-wife and sister to listen in on the calls. When his sister listened, her head fell as she confirmed that her brother was indeed the one making the distressing calls. To supplement this discovery, the exact same MO and assault was made for both Denise and Barbara, who was discovered with stab wounds from a screwdriver. It was the series of testimonies that followed that clinched Paul's next sentence, a 40-year sentence for the second-degree murder of Barbara Simmons.
While locked away in the Oak Parts Heights prison in Minnesota, Paul left a gaping hole in the justice system for the families of other victims. Thanks to the court's policy on voice testing, Paul was not being pursued actively for the cases of Karen Potack or of Kimberly Compton, whose attacks were just as grievous as the others. Their families lay in discontent while the cases were placed on permanent hold. So although Barbara and Denise received dutiful justice from the state, the other victims were left unconsidered. It was Paul, though, who had really kept the truth from reaching these grieving people. Paul, the second of 10 siblings, had spent time before his killings as a janitor and then as a shipping clerk. He made it out to St. Paul, and his work and family life had been rich before his time as a murderer. People knew him or knew of him, and some even thought him odd. But the man had a wife at one point, and a daughter. He had a life before he started taking lives. Perhaps it was because of these remnants of his past life that Paul had a stint of remorseful thought. Perhaps it was thanks to the thoughts of his daughter that he wanted to set the record straight. Perhaps even Paul had been so affected by his religious piety in childhood that the consistent reminders of his sins called out to him, "Confess, confess." Whatever the case, it wasn't enough anymore that his whiny calls had been confessions of their own. Paul called the police to have them come talk to him.
She got in my car and I gave her my jacket and told her, I said, the heat will be out in a minute. I said, I had to clean some of the ice off the windshield.
Do you remember where you hit her with the tire iron, Paul?
In the head.
Did you hit her one time, two times?
Must have been about 30 times, but I mean, a good 20 times, I think, it was.
Were you swinging it this way, or did you poke her with it?
No, I don't think I poked her. No. I remember just hitting her mainly on the forehead, on the cheek, and the jaw, the mouth, and the top of the head. And I think it was only about 10 times, because then I know she must really be hurting in that, you know, the steel bar like that. I was even hurt. When I went back to the car, there's going like this. I mean, and that's what made me want to go to the phone. I mean, I really wanted to help her. My mind started clearing up. What are you doing? You had a chance to make another friend. I kept yelling at myself. You like to make friends. And then that's when she started telling me where she was from, in Wisconsin and all. And I says, hey, why don't you, I'm not even thinking about hurting right now. I said, hey, why don't you let me show you downtown? I said, I want to show you something. There's really a nice view over here. I mean, you see the nice river. I think I mentioned somebody you can probably you have something to tell your parents about them. Because I walked out of the car, I carried my knife with me. I had every intention to hurt me. We laid down in the grass, and I remember opening up her bra, and you know, just feeling the stuff. And they just started stabbing me. Killing seemed to be the thing you were supposed to do. That was part of life. Driving the car was part of life. Eating food was part of life. To me, it seemed like killing was part of life. Until I did it, and then I drove away, and then I looked like the one on Pierce Petter Road. What are you doing? And then I just couldn't turn myself in. That's why I kept getting on the phone. Will your cats be in stop me, or catch me, or something like that, or...
You say that you both got into the tub?
Yes.
And you're positive about that?
Yes. Because, I mean, when I pushed her head underwater, I could see her face.
Did you push her in by her, push her head down, or did you push her in the chest area under the water?
I held her shoulders down.
You held her shoulders down? Both hands then?
The police came to interview Paul, and when they did, they discovered that he had, in fact, killed Kimberly Compton. He had also been the one to beat Karen Potak so brutally that she had been near death at the time she was discovered, bleeding and broken in the snow. He even confessed to one more crime. He had killed another woman, one by the name of Kathleen Greening. This case was an odd one, which had taken on a life of its own. Without a weepy call to the authorities or the usual stabbing of the victim, the police had no reason to tie the particular crime in with the other serious misdeeds of the weepy voice killer. However, as he was going on age 53, Paul admitted to this deed alongside his others. He confessed to drowning Kathleen in her bathtub before placing her outside her home. For 4 years, Kathleen's cause of death was ruled undetermined, only being considered a homicide in 1986 upon a new ruling by the medical examiner. The governor himself overstepped his jurisdiction by requesting a secret probe investigation into the so-called homicide, upon a nudge from Kathleen's friend Carol Kellogg. Governor Carlson's investigation eventually looked into the methods of his former political challenger, Tom Foley, the former county attorney who presided over the case. Another friend of Kathleen's criticized Foley specifically for failing to implicate the estranged husband in her murder, a criticism which found its way to the WCCO-TV's investigative team. Foley, in turn, later sued WCCO-TV for libel, claiming they suggested he was interfering with the very investigation of Kathleen's death. While all of this occurred, it remained unknown for years that Paul Michael Stefani was the actual killer, and the unresolved nature of the case had left many people close to Kathleen in the same boat as the other families. It was only during Paul's arrest and subsequent confessions that the dots were finally being fully connected. Of course, that didn't mean that justice was served. For Paul, one wish had actually come true. He told dispatchers in his anonymous calls that he would much rather die than to end up in prison. In fact, the same year that he shared his confessions with law enforcement, he also discovered he had skin cancer. In 1998, Paul died of skin cancer complications, earning his wish before earning yet another helping of jail time for the additional crimes he committed. Before he died, though, he did make a point of saying he was sorry. He said to the Star Tribune in December of 1977, "Since I've been locked down the last 15 years, I've wondered how all this could happen, and all I can say is I'm sick and I'm sorry, if sorry means anything after 15 years. In a way unprecedented by most serial killers, Paul had found a way to experience and express remorse, even if most of his expressions were over high-pitched whines on a payphone."
Paul Stefani, for all intents and purposes, wasn't experiencing some sort of delusion in the heat of his actions.
He suffered from mental illness throughout his life, yes, but during those episodes, he was, according to most psychoanalyses, himself. He would, at one point or another, stop himself, much like one can learn to do in the heat of an argument. At that point, Paul would experience worry and remorse for his actions, convincing himself in desperation that his phone calls would help, whether it would help Karen, who was alive but beaten, or whether it would help future women in the wake of his murderous episodes. Paul had created for himself a version of reality in which his calls were a way to fix the situation. Contrary to most serial killers, whose need for attention does not typically line up with remorseful expressions, Paul's need was, or seemed to be, for absolution. He believed that, due to his actions, he would not be going to heaven. Perhaps it was this belief that spurred his calls after each assault, each murder, each sexual act, or perhaps like many people in this confusing world, Paul simply acted on impulse, without reason, in both his attacks and his potent, pathetic cries for help. Whatever the case, it's helpful to be reminded of the power of real remorse and shame. It keeps us in check, and it serves as a memento for our humanity. Maybe it's one thing that sorts us out from the sly thing in the shadows, the killer in waiting. Maybe it's what helps separate us from the devil we know. Thank you for listening to another edition of Devil We Know. That voice you heard in between mine is Father Sin from The Sinful Show. Please check out his show on all podcast platforms. You can also help out Devil We Know by going to patreon.com/devilweknowpodcast and subscribing for $1 to receive 2 bonus episodes a month, stickers, and other perks. I would also like to apologize to all the listeners of last week's episode. We had an editing problem. I uploaded the wrong file and then had a heck of a time getting the correct file back in its place. I understand your frustration. As a podcaster, that should not happen, and it won't happen again. Thank you. And here is an amazing podcast that I found and became friends with. Real Life, Real Crime by Woody Overton. Amazing podcast. Please check out the promo and then subscribe to his podcast.
I'm Woody Overton, host of Real Life, Real Crime, the podcast. Join me each week to hear true and unscripted stories of the cases I actually worked during my career as a major crime investigator in South Louisiana. Go to realliferealcrime.com where you can listen to each week's episodes and find links to our social media. I appreciate y'all. Don't let me catch you down on the bayou.